Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Phyllis Schneck, Deputy Undersecretary for Cybersecurity and Communications within the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Melinda Balthrop. So, Phyllis, I'd like to set some context and define specific terms. What is cyberspace, and why has it become such a critically important part of Homeland Security to secure it, and would you define cybersecurity?
Another great big question. I'm going to start a little bit out of order and steal a quote from our secretary. One of the first things that I learned and heard Secretary Johnson say was, cybersecurity is a part of Homeland Security, and it is treated internally as a key priority. When I look at cyberspace, I think of all things electronically connected. Okay. So can one machine talk to another machine, whether the machine is these days a car, a refrigerator, a laptop, a mobile phone, some device? All of that connectivity, that communication would count, in my mind, as what we have to secure as cyberspace. So that covers those things that the National Protection and Programs Directorate want to look at as mitigation of consequences and risks. Where are you connected? What electronic devices control what water flows into a valve that creates, whether it's water purification or something that happens at a nuclear site, where are those, all of those interconnects count as part of cyberspace? And the tricky part to us, or one of the tricky parts, is that not all of them are governed by the same ways of communicating or protocols. So when you hear people talk about industrial control systems or, quote, SCADA, supervisory control and data acquisition, which is the monitoring of those systems, all of those systems speak a different language than, say, your printers and your computers. But all of that's electronically driven, computer logic driven interconnectivity. And to me, all of that is cyberspace. So the reason we want to secure it, first of all, we know that we're not going to keep all bad guys out. Mm-hmm. We know that we can't prevent all unintentional events from occurring. Systems get built, harm can happen. What we want to do is, number one, understand these systems, and that's why we work so closely with the experts in infrastructure, you know, whether it's transportation, railroad, water, aviation, understanding how the world works, and then understanding where the cyber connectivity is. Number two, having the best-in-class experts to understand how to fight the bad guy when they enter, because they will, and they probably already have. How to, and this is very important to us, keep you online while we're mitigating the risk. So you don't want to take a business out to chase a piece of malware and figure out where it's gone. You want to work with them so that they don't lose online time, but to also minimize any further harm and to understand what happened there enough to protect others. And the security of this is so important because these interconnected systems are increasingly driving, no pun intended with the cars, but everything that we do. Yes. And it's convenient and it's fun to be able to send somebody something on a cell phone and take a picture of where you are, or FaceTime as I do with my little niece. But these systems also bring risk because they have not, when we built the internet, we did not build in cybersecurity. And that's been said by many, but going forward, there's no excuse for not building risk and consequence-based cybersecurity into every piece of cyberspace or that electronically connected infrastructure. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask, and if you haven't touched on it, could you give us a sense, maybe outline the key cyber threats facing public and private sectors alike?
So that's a dynamic question. If you take it at a high level, out of the Klingon, as I say, we need to do some very, very simple things. Change your password. Watch. Don't click on links. These seem like simple, rudimentary items, but certain vectors, for example, spear phishing, which is where somebody sends you an email or any phishing that looks like it's for you from a specific sender, and it really is not, as that's actually an adversary at the other end, collecting your money or your intellectual property or simply to try to get access to your machine. When you click on a link that someone sends you, you are inviting risk. It's like receiving a box from someone you don't know and just opening it right up. It's come into your home, and you're now going to give it full access. So change your password, type your own web links in. If you're ever not sure, call the provider. Say, did you send me this note? Watch your machine. Is it behaving differently, et cetera? Understand the different threats that are out there. For citizens, they're a little bit different than for companies. But overall, we have found that three or four good cyber practices will tend to mitigate a good number of the big events. And that will also reduce the amount of noise and let the experts focus on the things that are most sophisticated. You know, it's for the sake of hockey season, put a goalie in the net
Executive Order 13636, Improving Critical Infrastructure Cybersecurity, and Presidential Policy Directive PPD 21, Critical Infrastructure Security and Resilience, set out steps to strengthen the security and resilience of the nation's critical infrastructure. Would you tell us more about them and the department's efforts to implement their requirements?
So every great effort deserves a great acronym, and I will introduce, if you haven't heard it already, C-Cubed VP, Critical Infrastructure Cybersecurity Community Voluntary Program. And what all of that means is that around the release of the executive order, the Office of Cybersecurity and Communications at DHS created this program to bring together our critical infrastructure experts, our cyber experts, in a voluntary program that forms a community of those that are looking at the best practices labeled in the framework. That could be large companies that have already most likely implemented that even before the framework existed. They actually contributed to what the best practices should be. To the smaller companies. Now, small to medium business makes up 99% of our business fabric. So not securing them not only makes them unsafe on their own and costs them money, it also makes them easy launch pads into the large companies that they serve through the supply chain. And it also deprives us, as the folks who are trying to mitigate cyber threat and respond to cyber threat, it deprives us of the awareness and understanding of what threats are posed to those companies. So in engaging them in this voluntary, again, we are not regulating. We're providing best practices and standards so that small companies can, in future budget cycles, invest resources in locking their networks the same way they lock their doors and bring it to their boardrooms, no matter how large or small, so that, one, they're safer, two, all those they serve are safer, and three, those that are trying to protect them, government or private sector, have more of a situational awareness across that 99% of our business fabric of who is trying to knock on the door illegally, so that we can protect everybody else based on that information. And this program provides all the resources we have in cybersecurity at DHS, whether it is cyber resilience reviews, which we post online on our website. We can give you full resources and reports on how to look at your entire network and do reports. You do not have to report that back to us. That's just for you. We can send people out if necessary to help you. And we can certainly work with you electronically. Again, the idea here is to give full resources to support the best practices listed in the framework, a risk and consequence-driven solid investment in cybersecurity boardroom down.
While nearly all of our systems and networks are globally interconnected, our defensive capabilities are not. To what extent do our adversaries exploit a fundamental asymmetry in our network infrastructure? And how would sharing cyber threat indicators in a near real time reduce that asymmetry?
So the sharing of cyber threat indicators has been in the news a lot. Yeah. It has been on the Hill a lot. That's because it's critical. The asymmetry that the adversaries enjoy is speed. I can humorously again tell you that it is likely stems from the fact that they don't have any laws or lawyers or really any way of life or any boundaries, right? So that would be very easy to execute, especially when you have the ultimate allowance of budget. So the way we have to look at that is holistically. Why is this happening to us? It's happening because machines are not smart, but they are really fast. So the adversary exploits that because they understand that a machine simply pulls its next instruction from a list. It doesn't know that that next instruction is telling it, is from an adversary in these cases, and telling it to do something bad, such as send all of your intellectual property to Jupiter. Right? We want to understand how to reach these machines before the adversary does, how to educate them. Your body, if you get a cut, I was in a four-hour meeting 2 weeks ago with a splinter, and this is what I thought about. My finger really hurts, and my whole body's responding to it. And it really hurt because of that. If one machine on the network really hurts, our other machines don't know about it yet. The rapid sharing of cyber threat indicators increases the probability that the right information will be at the right machine at the right time so that when the bad instruction comes in, it will not be executed. Even if it's accepted, it may not be executed through a variety of technologies. We do have a science challenge that we've talked about and are talking about from both a technology and machine perspective of how do we get the right information always to the right place at the right time. And while nothing's perfect, this is a big challenge. It starts with having a central place, and think about weather for a minute, having a central place where all of the temperature, humidity, and wind speed indicators are gathered so that we can understand the difference between a rainstorm a supercell thunderstorm, and a high probability of a tornado, and that we can give that in machine-readable speed to these very interconnected things that we mentioned comprise that which is cyberspace.
Mm-hmm. So, Phyllis, would you tell us more about the mission and purpose of DHS's National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center? How does it foster the coordination and integration of cyber situational awareness and incident management?
Our NCIC is the core. It's the heart and soul of that rapid information sharing. So the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center hosted our President Obama on 13 January. And in his remarks to our team that day, he indicated that that would be where the central collection of cyber threat indicators is housed with targeted liability protection to those who send those indicators there. And let me put that into some non-Klingon for fun. It means that the raw materials of cyber threat indication, so not a social security number, not your name, not what you ate that day, but really machine-readable, executable code that would indicate that this code is going to do something to your machine, such as tell it to talk to others or share things with others where it shouldn't. At DHS, we are uniquely positioned as a civilian agency with the only statutory privacy officer in civilian government to work directly with experts in privacy and civil liberties so that in this time where it is so hard to bring a lot of information together, but it is so urgent, we can do that. That's our job in the NCIC. But it's also important to point out that we've been doing this, quote, near real time or very fast, if you will, information sharing as long as we've lived. It's been done by having people representing our brothers and sisters in the law enforcement community, whether that's our FBI friends, whether it's our intelligence community friends, representatives of different sectors such as state and local. We have a representative from the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which is a wonderful nonprofit organization that brings together many of the states to share cybersecurity information. We have representatives from other sectors and their ISACs, such as aviation and others. That NCIC has been able to bring those people together to have the information shared rapidly, and now through innovation in how machines talk, two protocols that I believe will be SAT words in 2 years, but STICS and TAXI. But the ways that machines talk, the NCIC delivered that capability 5 weeks early and is ready to rapidly share all the indicators we can with those who are able to receive them.
I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the National Institute of Standards and Technology's cybersecurity framework, and tell us a little bit about the framework itself, but more importantly, how is your office working with states and territories to provide managed security services in conjunction with their adoption of this
So
framework?
As I finished up the last thought on the NCIC, a 24/7 watch center, one of the screens we have in the NCIC shows all of the states and how they self-report the health of their network as they see it. And they put that together so that you can start to see, again, that situational awareness of which states are seeing what and where. This is very important because in my experience, both in private sector and now in government, state and local governments have a tremendously urgent mission. They also house a lot of information for their state and their people about critical infrastructure, driver's license numbers. So they have a lot to protect. And state and local budgets are woefully small. So as we start to look at how to support that, one of the first things I did coming in was have the department and our office write a check, basically, that said we are going to fund managed security services for those states that are willing to adopt and start looking at the framework so that in future budget cycles, money is there at a high level at the state's office so that they can do a better job of investing in cybersecurity based on the tenets in the framework as a risk-consequence equation. We've also worked with others such as the Chamber and other organizations to get these same principles into the small to medium business and issued a request for information for small to medium business to say, and this is very important to me coming from the private sector, how might you make a lot of money securing everybody else? So are there private sector businesses out there that can create a faster, better, more efficient solution that also makes them a lot of money? So that we are literally paying for innovation while we're better securing our infrastructures and taking a better global lead in cybersecurity. So we have leveraged that framework that was created by our best scientists in the country to push back out new ways of investing. And in the case of the state and local, for the first little bit, we actually paid for that because it was that critical.
I'd like to understand more about the Regional Resiliency Assessment Program. And where I'm going with this is, how does this program assist your office to identify cross-sector physical and cyber interdependencies and better understand the consequences of disruptions?
That Regional Resiliency Assessment Program, and I will go government on you and say we affectionately call it the RRAP, that program helps us fuse cyber and infrastructure protection. It says, and regionally is very important, if something happens in the Southeast,
yes.
I spent a long time in Atlanta from my graduate work. When something happened in Atlanta, our first thought wasn't to call Washington. It's what is regionally around me, because that's where the effects are, that's where the experts are. And so we want to start to look at, and this is what our Infrastructure Protection Office does so well, is they not only have people on the street there that represent DHS, they're called Protective Security Advisors, or PSAs. These are people that are familiar with the people and the infrastructure in the states and the regions, but also look at how are those pieces of infrastructure connected, how do they work from a cyber perspective, and what's the overall program or chart that we can start to look at, what are the vulnerabilities, how can we go, whether it's going down there or working with them remotely, help them to seal up a lot of those vulnerabilities and at the very least be aware of them, and always know who to call.
How is DHS building capacity to accelerate the sharing of cyber threat information? We will ask Dr. Phyllis Schneck, Deputy Undersecretary for Cybersecurity and Communications within the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.